I'm sorry. I was just further meditating on the mysteries of the discounted cash flow models and dividend discount models. Let's turn this down a little bit for you. Okay, let's get restarted again. Sorry. Indulgences. Slide 35. Dear students, you are going to know a technique that most everybody has no idea even exists, but it's very important in the world of finance. These are the kind of techniques you would learn in a upper division or graduate level finance and investment class. But you're giving them an introduction to investment class at the community college, so don't tell anybody. I mean, tell everybody. Slide 35. The discounted cash flow model is by far my favorite version of the dividend discount model. It uses the present value of expected dividends and the present value of the expected future price to value a share of stock, which in my mind makes perfect sense. It's also called the dividends and earnings model, but I don't know why, because it doesn't use earnings, it uses dividends. But I guess you can't pay dividends unless you make earnings. So I guess that's why they call it that. Anyway, the value of stock, the formula is actually very straightforward. The value of the stock is equal to the present value of the future dividends. Well, that sounds a little bit familiar, doesn't it? And the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell the stock. We use the present value multipliers from the table. Now, it's kind of sad that this is not specifically covered in our text. They just assume that you're going to figure it out from the pure form of the dividend discount model that we discussed at the beginning of the previous presentation. But that one was flawed because after 3 years, remember, there were three payments of $100 each and then the stock disappeared. The company went bankrupt. Like, I don't know. But this one uses the final cash flow as the price of the stock. In other words, after 3 years or 4 years or whatever, the company, hopefully, is still in business. So what's it worth then? That's what we're going to do in just a minute, so relax. As with the other dividend discount models, this model is very sensitive to our estimates and our choice of required rate of return, and hence can be very far off the mark. In other words, everybody is requiring a different rate of return, and so everybody's estimates are just, you know, all over the map, everywhere. Slide number 36. Here's our example. Now, I want you to get out a sheet of paper because we don't necessarily want you to do the calculations on this page. Wait until the next page. Make sure you understand what's going on. Maybe you want to pause and actually do the calculations, but hang on a minute because we're going to see a better form, an easier way to do it on the next slide. Plus, if you are savvy with spreadsheets, this one is out there as a spreadsheet. So you're eventually going to want to play with the spreadsheet. Let's assume it's January 1st, 2015. Pretzels Unlimited, I like pretzels, is currently selling for $22 per share. And they will pay $2 per share in dividends in 2015. How do we know? Well, that's what they're paying now. That's what we assume they're going to continue to pay. And we or they expect to increase their dividends to $2.20 in 2016, $2.30 in 2017, $2.30 in 2018. And we believe that we will be selling the stock at the end of 2018. We expect the price to be $27 per share at that time, at the end of 2018. And here's where we have to decide what our required rate of return is. So let's make it 12%. Let's say we want to see 12% from PU. So the formula, as we said, is equal to the present value of the future dividends plus the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell it in 3, 4, 5 years. So the calculations become $2 times 0.893. Now, where did I get the 0.893? Okay, pull out the present value tables. Hopefully you've printed them out or have them on your screen somewhere. If you don't, go get them now. Go across to 12% and down 1 year, down year number one, and you'll see 0.893. Now, do it now. Come on, go do it. Don't wait. Well, maybe you can wait till later, but make sure you do it. And then in the year 2016, we expect to get $2.20, and we're going to discount that. That's the verb we use. We use the verb discount. We say we're going to discount that $2.20 by multiplying it times the present value multiplier for 12% for 2 years. So go across to 12%, down 2 years, and you should see 0.797. Okay, you understand? This is what we did at the beginning of the previous presentation. But we used 15%, which I think is ridiculous. Then we do that for 2017, where we have $2.30 times 0.712. That's the present value multiplier for year number three. And then in year number four, we're going to get two future cash flows. We're going to get the dividend for year number four, 2018. So we discount that by 0.636, the present value multiplier for 12% for 4 years. Plus, we treat the price, the expected price of the stock, as a cash flow, because we could turn around and sell the stock then. And we believe the stock is going to be $27. Now, some people will use year number five. Don't make that mistake. It's the same year. It's year number four, 2018. All right, and we'll see the spreadsheet, and we'll see it makes it look a little bit easier. So if you do all those calculations, you wind up with a present value of the stock of about $23.81. So what does that mean? Well, the market is offering us a stock for $22. And after we do our valuation technique, the discounted cash flow model, we believe the stock is worth $23.81. If our required rate of return is 12%, then for us, this is a pretty good stock to buy. Now, we're going to repeat this over and over again. Just because this number comes out at $23.81, does that mean that's what it really is worth? Does that mean it's going to pay these dividends in the future? Does that mean going to be worth $27 in 4 years? No, we are blowing smoke. We are setting up mirrors, and we are forecasting the weather. We are just tilting the odds in our favor. We're making wild predictions, so we want to eliminate any pretense of precision. What does that mean? In other words, our numbers are just swags. You might have heard swag or peduma, picked it directly out of midair. Swag stands for stupid, wild, yes. They come from the military. Slide number 37. Here is an easier way, in my humble opinion, to set up the problem. That's why I said, maybe don't do the calculations yet. Wait till the next slide. Set them up in a spreadsheet, in a table format. Put the years down here. In 2015, 2016, 17, and then Y2, because remember, we're going to get the dividends in these years, $2 in 2015, $2.20 in 2016, $2.30 in 2017, $2.30 in 2017, and then we treat the price of the stock. It doesn't go away. Maybe it does if it's Kodak, but hopefully it doesn't for our sake. It's $27 in 2018. And then we place the present value multipliers next to it and do the calculations in table format, right? Yeah, there are the calculations. Do them to make sure I got them right. Make sure you don't trust me. You want to make sure I did it right. and add up all those calculations and you get $23.81. Now, I think it's much easier to comprehend and calculate in this format. Do you agree? I think it just makes it more straightforward. Plus, we're doing an extra calculation here that we don't have to do at the last year. Let's rearrange the table so that we eliminate a couple of manual calculations. Let's just have one row for every year. We're on slide number 38 now. And you see in 2015 we have a cash flow of $2. In 2016, $2.20. In 2017, $2.30. And then in 2018, we have the dividend of $2.30 plus the $27 that we expect the stock price to be. So that's a total of $29.30 of cash flows in the final year. So that eliminates an extra multiplication and addition. You like it? And not only does it save us a couple of manual calculations, but more importantly, dear students, it also allows us to use a special spreadsheet function to calculate the internal rate of return. Slide number 39. The internal rate of return is a measure of what rate of return we expect to get from a series of cash flows, including the positive and the negative cash flows, the inflows and the outflows. Someday, dear students, when you take an upper level or graduate finance or investment class, you will learn how to manually compute the internal rate of return, and hopefully you will not have a sadistic professor who will require you to calculate it more than once manually, because it's not easy. That's why we have computers. We're simply going to enter the numbers into a spreadsheet formula and press the enter key. Okay? In other words, we initially required a 12% rate of return from Pretzels Unlimited. But what do our numbers tell us will be our expected rate of return? What do the numbers say to us? Knowing that they're just, you know, blowing smoke and mirrors and putting our finger up in the wind and seeing which way the wind blows. What do the numbers say? Well, the spreadsheet formula makes it very easy to calculate that. The spreadsheet formula in Excel, is equal sign IRR for internal rate of return, and then the block of values that we are going to receive and pay. You have to include the outflows, what we paid for the stock to begin with. We weren't doing that in the calculation because we just assumed that's how much we were paying. But in the internal rate of return formula, we have to say how much we paid for the stock. And then what we can do is put the approximate rate of return. This is just our guess. You can leave it zero, and the spreadsheet will do its best to figure it out. Or you can put the number that you think it's close to. Either way, because that's how, when you do it manually, that's how you do it, folks. You start with a guess, and then you work your way towards the actual number. And that's why it's sadistic unless you're a real math fan, which I am, and I personally love doing these things, but I still use a spread. I mean, I would use a program to do it. I would program it into the, because I used to be a programming professor, but that was half a million years ago. Anyway, I digress. My fault. So it becomes very, very simple, folks. In the spreadsheet, you put in the cash outflow. Our initial outlay is $22. So you enter that as a negative number because we had to pay $22. And you don't need the years. I'm putting them there, but let's put them there. Year zero means January 1st, 2015. And then in 2015, we're going to get $2. And in 2016, we're going to get $2.20. And in 2017, we're going to get $2.30. And in 2018, we're going to get the $2.30 from the dividend plus the ability to sell the shares at $27, our expected value of the shares in 4 years. And we put in that formula equals IRR, internal rate of return, B2 to B5, assuming this is A1, folks. If you're not familiar with spreadsheets, you really ought to familiarize yourself with them because they are awesome tools and makes investing a whole lot easier and much more fun, in my humble opinion. And the spreadsheet comes back and says, oh, I see, you thought it was 12%, but the numbers actually say that this is a 14.5% rate of return. Assuming this is what you get. Assuming this is what you get from the stock, which is a big assumption, folks. So see, you don't even have to use the present value tables, and this spreadsheet is up there on the website, and of course in the face-to-face class, this is when I would show the students, let's take a look, folks, and let's see how easy it is to play with the numbers, and let's say, okay, well, maybe we're not going to get this much, let's lower the numbers and the like, and see what happens, and play, and literally just play, because we said we're just predicting the weather. So slide number 41. Example number 2. Genes are us. Symbol GRUS is currently selling for $21 per share, but it pays no dividends. We believe that Genes are us will sell for around $50 per share in 5 years because they're a cool, exciting, high-tech biotech company here in San Diego, and this is the kind of company that I was a sucker for. And they would go up very quickly because they're really awesome, and then something bad would happen, and then they would fall precipitously. But let's say our required rate of return is 13%. How can we determine if this is a good investment? Well, with no dividends, which model can we use? The discounted cash flow model can still be used. Why? Because we are using not only future dividends, well, future dividends in this case are zero, we're also using the present value of the price of the stock when we plan to sell. And so we know we're not going to get any dividends. They're losing money. They're trying to get off the ground with this new hot new technology. But we expect the stock price to be $50 in 5 years. And if we require a 13% rate of return, you got your present value table out, go across the 13%, down 5 years, and you should see 0.543. Do you see that? Indeed, the present value of $50 in 5 years at 13% is $27.13 because we have discounted that cash flow. Unlike the other dividend discount models, the other DDMs, the discounted cash flow model can be used if there are no dividends. Very cool. Do you understand? Do it again. And then this is when in the face-to-face class we would run to the worksheet number 1 and do the two problems that are there for the stalwart company that has been paying dividends for many years and the high-tech startup that doesn't pay any dividends and might be worth a certain number of dollars in 3 to 5 years. We don't know. And hopefully, not only will you be able to do these calculations, you will also get an appreciation for the very different types of companies that are out there. The stalwarts of the world that we looked at in the previous presentation, and the Genes Are Us of the world, the high-tech, biotech, social media companies that may explode on the upside but ain't paying us any dividends now, or may implode, highly speculative, as Mr. Benjamin Graham would say. So do those calculations over and over and over again, because there's two worksheets, and there's the assignment, and then there's going to be an exam, and I want you to know how to do these. If there's one thing, I think I said it, you're going to understand how to discount a future stream of cash flows. That's the verb we use, discount. Slide 42. the residual income model. Another method that is yet another cousin, sibling, relative of the DEDMs is the residual income model. As with the discounted cash flow model, it allows us to value a company that is not paying dividends. Because instead of using dividends, the model uses earnings. It's very similar to the constant perpetual growth model we saw in the previous presentation, but look, let's skip it for now. Maybe we'll come back to it later, but I think you have enough on your plate as it is. And ditto for all the other models described in Chapter 6, because there are dozens, dear students. These are not the only ones out there. But I think, especially the constant perpetual and the dividend, the discounted cash flow models are certainly two of the most powerful ones. By the way, the residual income model was introduced in the 4th, 5th, and 6th editions, and so I don't think anybody has the 3rd edition, but if you do, it's not in there. So go to the library, because we have a couple of books at the Southwestern College, textbooks on reserve, which I think I told you, in the Southwestern College main campus library. Slide 43. Okay, Piano, you know, this is all great, but just where are we supposed to get all this historical information anyway? And just who decides what next year's earnings per share, sales per share, cash flow per share, dividends per share are expected to be, let alone the expected price of the stock in 3 to 5 years? Well, before the internet, should that be BI? This information was not readily available. Normally, you would go and ask your broker for it, or you would use one of the securities industry's trusted information sources. And traditionally, the most respected source was the Value Line. Slide 44. Still, one of the most respected and trusted sources of data and analysis. And traditionally, it was often the only source many investors used for data and analysis, along with the company's materials, of course. You know, look at what the company published for what we're going to take a look at next chapter, the balance sheet, the income statement, the statement of cash flows. If you joined one of the National Association of Investors Corporation, now called BetterInvesting.org, investment clubs, I mean, the Value Line was it, folks. That's what they used. It ain't cheap. It is very expensive. It's $600 a year, and I thought they were giving you a discount if you went online, but it looks like they got rid of that. So you can get the paper sent to you, or you just go online and look at it. But, folks, you can go to a library for free and look at this, and this is what I do. I know it might sound silly, but this is my idea of a great afternoon. Sunday afternoon, often my wife and I go to the Point Loma Library, because they have it at they don't have it at all libraries. Southwestern canceled it during the financial turmoil, because it ain't cheap, as we said. And she immerses herself in historical novels, and I immerse myself in the Value Line. Especially the timeliness and safety factors, you look at those, because one study, this was several years ago, but it ignored transaction costs and tax consequences. It only used their timeliness indicator. It showed how you would have beaten the market handsomely, meaning the Standard & Poor's 500, over a 20-year period by simply buying and selling stocks as they received and lost their number one timeliness designation. Now, I'm not suggesting you do this. It probably won't work in the future. It might have been a fluke, but it's a very good indicator. They now have a couple of options. For much less money, you can take a look at the biggest 600 companies. Remember the large cap blue chip stalwarts. And also, for much less money, they have, I don't know how many, a few thousand small cap and mid cap companies. But you're going to limit the number of small cap and mid cap companies in your portfolio, right? The spice, you do what you want, but it didn't work out too well for me. But I knew it going in. See, that's the thing. I knew it going in. So let's take a look at the Value Line. There's an example in your book on the 6th edition on page 206, but of course the 5th edition is somewhere there and the 4th edition is somewhere there. It's somewhere close to there in the chapter 6 chapter. Can you find the indicators, the future price projections, the historical data, the cash assets, the receivables, the inventory, the other assets, the description and analysis, the business, the historical annual rates, the insider institutional buying and selling, the amount of debt, number of shares outstanding, the company's financial strength, stability, price growth, and earnings predictability ratings? Well, they use McGraw-Hill. And there's a reason on slide 46 why they use McGraw-Hill. That's the company that made your textbook. And McGraw-Hill also is the company that owns Standard & Poor's 500. So you got to know the authors when they went to the editor and said, look, we want to use the Valuation. And McGraw-Hill said, but why don't you look at Standard & Poor's? Because Standard & Poor's has the same kind of service as Valuation. But, and I haven't seen it in a long time, folks. It's been almost 10 years. We used to get them. They sent, because we were one of the, I was a member of an investment club, they sent us, S&P 500 sent us their competitors for free. Not all of them, but several. And because they were trying to get us to sign up, and they know that at the time, that maybe they're better. I don't know. I haven't looked. But they're not as good as the Valuation. And so the authors said, no, we want the Valuation. Okay, fine. I'm glad they did, because it is a better. Again, I don't know. I haven't seen the Standard & Poor's sheets in a long time, so I don't know if they've gotten better. But look at this thing. Look at this. If you're looking at this on a mobile device, you can't see any of this. You're going to have to go to the library or go to your book or go to a computer. But look at all this information. Sales per share, cash flow per share, earnings per share, dividends per share, book value, average annual P.E. ratio, relative P.E. See where we're going to get all this information? How do we get the five-year P.E. average? In the first presentation, the price ratio models, the price to cash flow, the price to sales. Yeah, here it is. Plus, this is the really cool part. Look at what they do, folks. That's why we look at this 3 to 5 year time frame. That's why I keep repeating this. Because that's about all you would ever want to predict into the future. Even, and you don't do it, you let Valuation do it. See, in this is what, late 2009, when the 6th edition was done, and the price of McGraw-Hill was about $28.73, and you see what they're showing you? We believe the sales per share about 2012 to 2014 will be $22.90, and the cash flow per share and the earnings per share, and we believe the stock price will be between $48 and $65 or so. So here you go, folks. You don't have to just throw a number up into the air. You go to the Valuation, and you see, well, this is what Valuation thinks. Maybe we'll pick these numbers. Indeed, yes. I mean, I love to dance around and say, look, this is, and the truth is, they've been pretty darn good, folks. Slide 47 is the bottom of the page where they give you more information about the current position in cash and receivables and inventory and their annual rates of sales and cash flow and earnings and dividends, quarterly sales, earnings per share, and then the company's judgmental decisions or analysis of where we think things are going, and talk about McGraw-Hill. Very cool. I think, it's a sip from the fire hose. And in November of 2009, they were pretty positive on McGraw-Hill. They were pretty positive on many companies, because remember, this was the depth of the 2008-09 crisis. Let's put Valuation to the test on slide 48. In late 2009, the price was around $29, and their price prediction for early 2013 was in the range from around $48 to $68. Well, on February 15th, 2013, McGraw-Hill's price closed at $44.95, which is not too bad, folks. Actually, pretty darn good. When they made this prediction at the end of 2009, the stock market had rallied from the depths of the 2008 to 2009 crisis, but many people were still predicting the end of the world as we know it. And, oh, by the way, some of them are still predicting the end of the world. What amazes me is the fact that we have a president who doesn't get any credit for this whatsoever. They hate him. They absolutely hate him. If Obama were a Republican, they'd be jumping up and down saying, "This guy, look at how well the stock market has done under our president." And yet, they just trash the guy and say he has nothing to do with this. They don't say a And the Democrats are so dumb, they should be jumping up and down the way the Republicans would do and saying how phenomenal. But the truth be told, folks, as we're going to discuss in a future chapter, is just dumb luck on Obama's part. I mean, his administration did some things. The Republicans kept him from doing other things that they wanted to do. But he came in at a time when the market had crashed. You see? So, this is when you want to buy, but that's when people bought. I mean, literally, I had somebody in my classroom who was originally from Texas, and the day after Obama was inaugurated, she said that her relatives in the little town in Texas that she lived in had kept their children home from school because the Antichrist had been elevated, and they believed that the rapture was about to come. Uh-huh. Oh, well. Let's take a look at the value line prediction for the fourth edition. Because they're not always peaches and cream, these predictions. Slide number 49. Here it was, mid-2005, and they were expecting in 2008-09 the stock price to go from about 47 up to about 66 to 80. What happened? Here's the... go ahead and read about what their belief is on slide 50. How did they do in mid-2005? Slide 51. Well, their price prediction for late 2009 was in the 66 to 82 range, i.e., McGraw-Hill's price was hovering around $24 in late 2009. Well, what happened? Folks, they were right on until mid-2007. It reached $70 in mid-2007, but then started falling as the credit markets started reacting to the home mortgage loan crisis, the housing bubble. Remember that McGraw-Hill owns Standard & Poor's? You've heard of them, and they were the people who were giving these mortgage-backed bonds that we'll discuss in later chapter when we get to bonds. They were giving these mortgage-backed bonds that were based on these bogus loans that people, all they had to do was have a warm body and lie about how much money they were making. They were giving them AAA ratings and saying, "Oh, yeah, don't worry, these are the best things out there." And they promptly blew apart in investors' hands. And so Standard & Poor's was not a very popular company, folks. In fact, there were people who wanted to put them in jail. There's still people who want to put them in jail, and the bankers, and the mortgage folks, but not the people who bought the houses for hundreds of thousands of dollars more than they were worth and then disappeared. There's plenty of blame to go along. And so the stock plummeted as the home mortgage loan crisis spread to the entire financial sector in 2008 and 2009. Their mid-2000 prediction from the fifth edition of the text was even uglier. But again, that was the black swan, it's sometimes called. That was the event that nobody could have predicted. Now, I will tell you with all honesty that I believed that we were in for a rough time because of the housing bubble. I was sure it was a bubble. My buddy, who's much more aggressive investor than I am, was even more convinced. But I didn't think it was going to be anywhere near as bad as what it was. I thought housing prices would go down 20% or so, and I thought the stock market would go down about 20-30%. And my buddy kept jumping up and down and saying, "No, you don't understand. It's going to go down 50%. What? This market? No. Real estate's going to go down 50%. I said, "Jim, you got to go back to the Great Depression to see real estate fall that hard." And he said, you, I got people I'm working with who are making less money than I am, and they're qualifying for these loans that there's no way they're going to be able to pay in 2-3 years. And he was absolutely right. It was ugly. And hopefully it won't happen again, but those loans are still legal. They're not making as many as they used to, but they're still out there. What about their early 2003 prediction from the third edition? What about them? Slide 52. Well, in early 2003, they expect the price was about $54.50. Wait a minute, what's going on here? And they expected the price to be in the $90 to $110 range. There's the commentary on slide 53. In slide 54, in early 2003, the Value Line predicted that the price of McGraw-Hill would be around $90 to $100, $110 in 2005 and 6. Why so much higher? Well, they split their stock in the intervening time between the third and the fourth edition. It's 2-for-1. So you have to divide these prices by 2 to compare them to the fourth and the fifth and the sixth editions. So hooray for the Value Line. They were bang on the money, folks. McGraw-Hill reached the $120 level by the end of 2006. Remember, it was split adjusted. So it is uncanny sometimes how good they are. In 2009, you know, everybody was shell-shocked. I wasn't too happy walking around. I mean, I knew the world wasn't going to end, and if it did, it didn't matter. But still, I was not happy about losing. But I'm looking at the Value Line, and they're saying, you know, 3 to 5 years, we expect the market to rebound smartly. And you could just you know, wave a stick at stocks, and they're saying all the stocks they're looking at, the stalwarts, the big companies, are going to come back. And sure enough, they were right. I get a kick when some investors trash the Value Line. Those fuddy-duddies, those stodgy old farts, they don't know what they're doing. Well, like, they make mistakes, as we saw. They didn't see the bubble bursting in the housing crisis as much as everybody else. What they do is they have a... when you go to the library for the optional bonus assignment for Chapter 6, you will pick up the Value Line, and it might be in a huge binder, it might be in lots of little binders, and the first binder is the one that gives their analysis of what's going on. And reading it in late 2008 was like reading a horror story. They kept saying things like, well, you know, we don't think it's going to be so bad, and we're still cautiously optimistic that we'll make it through the housing bubble, and you know, obviously we've seen housing prices soften, and we think we're not going to go into recession. And then they start saying, well, you know, things don't look as good as we thought they were, and then they're saying things don't look good at all. In fact, it looks pretty darn bad. And I'm thinking, okay, it's a little late to sell, don't you think? Yeah, don't do it, don't panic, just ride it through. And I did. I would sure love to see how those investors who trashed the Value Line, I would sure love to see how their long-term results stack up against the long-term results of the Value Line. Who do you think would have the better results? They do have, at the library, and when you take a look at it, they have sample portfolios. You can use their sample portfolios, or you can just see what the kind of companies they believe for people who are aggressive growth investors, who are income-oriented investors, who want a balance of growth and income. Yeah. So, Do go to the library one afternoon, and there's a list of libraries on the website, the Chula Vista Main Library, the San Diego Central Library, and then several of the San Diego branch libraries, and immerse yourself in the Value Line. If you are so inclined, please do the bonus assignment for Chapter 6, because this, to me, is intelligent investing. You make prudent assumptions about where companies with long histories of earnings and dividend growth have their roots deep in the economy are going to do in 3, 4, 5 years, and then you continually reevaluate those numbers. But once you have done all your calculations, folks, once you've done all these different models, and if you go look at other different models, what do you do? Throw them away. Put them in the shredder. Burn them under a full moon in a campfire and dance around the, because that's exactly what they're worth. They are just predictions that may or may not come true, but in my humble opinion, you are going to tilt the odds in your favor. You are more likely going to win. Now, you may not win big with the next big thing, the next Titter and Farcebook and GoPro, but you're going to win. And that's what we're trying to do, isn't it? We're trying to win. We don't have to swing for the fences, throw the Hail Mary pass, if sports is your thing. We just need to hit singles. We just need to make it to the next 10-yard line. Peter Lynch, in his book One Up on Wall Street, described his process. He used three-ring binders for each company that he investigated. And he investigated literally thousands. One time he had 1,400 stocks in his portfolio. He was a big fan of stocks. I think that's the right number. I might be wrong. But he would make a three-ring binder, put all his paperwork on it, newspaper clippings, report, annual reports and the like, the value line. He'd do his own calculations. And then he would hold it in his hand before he made his buy and sell decision. Buy or sell decision. He would hold the three-ring binder up in his hand and give himself the 30, 60, 90-second story about why he is buying or selling or holding this company. You see? So he didn't shred all that material, and I'm not saying you should, but I'm just saying you want to ignore that and ask yourself, after you've done this, do I really want to own FedEx? Do I really want to own Nike? Do I really want to own J.P. Morgan Chase or Exxon or GoPro or Twitter or Facebook? Do I really want to own these companies? Because you, when you buy a stock, are part owner. And as Warren Buffett says, if you wouldn't want to own the entire company outright, don't buy any shares. If you would love to own FedEx, I'm not trying to say you should buy FedEx, I'm just this example of a company that's got its roots deep in the economy. UPS is its major competitor, and DHL is the German version. And then, of course, there's the United States Postal Service, which you can invest in. But if you really wanted to own Federal Express, the entire company, if you could, go ahead and buy 10 shares. And, of course, Warren Buffett's so big now that he goes out and buys the entire company. Dear students, I wish you much success. I want to hear in the future how your investment programs go. My goal, I want to produce the next Warren Buffett, the next Peter Lynch. I want you to go out there and go on a tear and buy companies with good long-term prospects that have roots deep in the economy and have done well over good times and, more importantly, bad times. Les deseo muchísimos éxitos, mis estudiantes. I wish you much success in the future. See ya, because we are done with Chapter 6. Our next chapter, unless you have the Chapter 3 edition, which you probably don't, is Chapter 17. Huh? Well, they moved it. It used to be Chapter 7, but they moved it to the back as one of the optional chapters to do. But I think it's pretty important. We're going to take a look at income statement, balance sheet, cash flow statement, the financial statements, and then do more ratio analysis. Be awesome, dear students.